After she had pulled the blinds aside and left the room, I looked cautiously round to see if my unseen visitors had left behind any trace of their presence. Remembering the particular sounds by the door, I looked in that direction, and saw that a picture hanging on the wall had been carefully moved round, so that instead of hanging straight, in a vertical position, it hung sideways, halfway between the vertical and horizontal positions. I got out of bed, and examined the picture and the chain that supported it. I found it was a most difficult feat to pull the chain round the patent fastener on the wall, as the links in the chain were of such a shape that they caught in the fastening each time one attempted to move it. One had carefully to lift both picture and chain slightly, and case the latter round the fastener in order to move it at all. Quite an effort must have been used to move the picture to the angle at which I found it. Moreover, it was not a light weight, being at least 20 inches in length, and about 12 inches across, framed and glazed, and weighing several pounds. As there were many lighter and more easily moved photographs and pictures in the room, I wondered why the unseen operators had chosen this particular one. It was a study of a girl in a garden. I did not know her, nor, as I explained before, did I know the subjects of any of the portraits in the room. On going downstairs, I went straight to my hostess, and asked her who the lady in the large picture near my bedroom door was. "Oh," she said, "that's an enlarged portrait of," mentioning the name of a well-known actress, whom my husband had often told me about, as he had seen her when she was quite a tiny baby. The picture had been enlarged from a snapshot, and belonged to my hostess's husband, who had probably been told by my husband that he knew the lady in it, and as it was the only portrait in the room that had any significance whatever in regard to my husband, they had evidently decided to move that particular one, with obvious success. Many pleasant memories must have been invoked in both their minds by this picture, and that fact probably accounted for the happy, almost merry, condition that I had sensed during their visit. Chapter 18. Dangers and Complications. Other experiences followed, showing me that beyond all shadow of doubt they can and do manifest on our plane when the conditions, of which at present we know so little, permit them to do so. The same conditions make it easy or difficult for us to visit their plane, and I feel sure that they mostly arise on our side rather than theirs. I have been told that the spiritual, mental, and emotional state of our plane constitutes a kind of fog which they penetrate with some difficulty. When we earthly mortals are living in, and expressing the higher side of our natures, spiritually and mentally, it is as if we create a clear space in the surrounding mist, in which the etheric visitors can more easily operate. If we wish for communion with the departed, we should take great care to think, speak, and act in such a way that will provide these ideal conditions, and only good will come of such intercourse if we do so. Our emotional and temperamental difficulties act adversely or otherwise when we attempt to visit the etheric planes. I am sure that our etheric counterparts are weighted by the quality of our usual mental outlook and general behavior in our daily lives on Earth. These personal conditions, or soul vibrations, appear to affect the etheric cord which connects the etheric body to the physical. The etheric cord of an insensitive, unprogressed, unimaginative individual would be very rigid and inelastic. I doubt if such a person would be able to exteriorize the astral body voluntarily at all, or maybe only to a slight extent. Of course, an accident which resulted in a severe shock, or the administration of a strong anesthetic would probably cause his etheric double to move out, though perhaps only for a short distance, away from his physical body. The inference is that the more spiritual our lives on Earth, the easier we make it for our friends over there to visit us, and the easier for us to visit them in their conditions. Unless we learn to control our thoughts and emotions, we run a greater risk of encountering difficulties when we try to embark on any astral travels. This I proved for myself within a few days of the incident of the moved picture. In the interval, I had been extremely worried about certain material matters which had cropped up unexpectedly, and I found myself scarcely able to cope with them. I worried about them a good deal, really more than I ought to have done. They were partly, if not entirely, connected with my husband's illness and passing, and I longed more than ever to see him in his present surroundings, so as to assure myself that they were happy ones, and that he was happy in them. On the night of May 17, 1935, I went to sleep, and found myself in a place which I knew was not of this world. There is some curious quality in the atmosphere of the astral planes, which is soon recognized when one has paid several visits to them. On this occasion, the surroundings in which I found myself were not so clear as usual. A thick mist seemed to envelop everything beyond the radius of a few square yards. I stood in an open doorway, looking into a room which was furnished in quite an ordinary way. A few feet away, standing with his back to me, was my husband. At last I thought, I'm seeing him on his own plane, now I shall learn something of his real conditions. I stepped forward and put both my arms round him. He turned quickly, I lifted my face and kissed him. A look flashed over his face as if he was glad to see me, but that the gladness was completely overshadowed by some overwhelming distress and suffering. I said, aren't you pleased to see me? Oh, yes, yes, he answered, but it's the pain. I'm in such dreadful pain. He released me, and walked up and down the room, his face grey and drawn with suffering, his breath apparently coming and going spasmodically in his efforts to control the agony he evidently felt. Nonplussed, I watched him, thinking to myself that if this were indeed his real condition, he was evidently in worse bodily plight than when he was living on earth. I felt overcome with misery, and I remember that an extremely selfish thought rushed unbidden into my mind. I said to myself, oh, I have got to face everything all over again, all the anxiety and torture of watching him suffer that I thought was over and done with. I thought he was safe and free from pain, and I've been glad to lose him physically in order that it should be so. How terrible to find out that our ideas of perfect bodily health over there have all been wrong. However, I pulled myself sharply together, and immediately banished these first unworthy thoughts, and made up my mind to face this unexpected state of affairs, and help him in some way, though I knew not how. Quickly I took hold of his arm, and led him to a couch in the room, saying, lie down there, I'll think of something to help you. The pain won't last long, I promise. I'll do something quickly to help you, I know I can. I promise. I seemed to be repeating these words over and over again, and while doing so I felt a curious pull, as if something was drawing me away from the place. I fought against it for a moment, loath to leave my husband in his unhappy plight. The pull increased. It had a strange magnetic quality. I felt myself drawn backward and downward, and lost consciousness of my surroundings until I found myself actually in my physical body in bed. Every detail of my experience remained clear in my mind. I lay there, feeling sad and dismayed. Morning came, and my maid brought my early tea. I poured some out, and while drinking it, I tried to reconstruct the unpleasant dream, and, calming my mind, I closed my eyes, and silently formed a prayer for help in understanding and interpreting the experience, or else banish it altogether from my memory. It seemed beyond my earthly comprehension. While I was doing this, I became aware that someone was sitting beside me on the left side of the bed, just near my pillow. I opened my eyes slightly without turning my head, knowing that the less we move about and disturb the conditions the better. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw it was my husband sitting near me, and I sensed he had come with some explanation of my dream. I closed my eyes again, and listened carefully while he spoke. He told me I must be neither dismayed nor surprised if I got several experiences of the same nature as the one of the previous night. In fact, he said, if I persisted in trying to visit him on his own plane during sleep, it was most likely that I should go on having them until my mind ceased to evoke painful memories of his earthly illness. My subconscious mind was full of such memories, which I kept in check in my daily life, but in sleep they reasserted themselves, and traveled along the astral cord from my physical brain to that part of my mind which was functioning in my etheric body, and colored its impression of whatever I might be doing or seeing on the etheric plane. In other words, my subconsciousness was able to interpose a screen, on which images were engraved of exaggerated fears and unhappy memories, between myself and reality. Now and again this screen became transparent, as if the false wore thin, and my consciousness made a desperate but only partly successful effort to break through it, and reveal a little of the truth behind. My husband said that I had visited him. He was present in the room I had seen, but was not in any pain, nor was he distressed in any way. He advised me to make up my mind not to be worried if unhappy, but false impressions asserted themselves into any of my future astral experiences, but that I must remember that they were purely subconscious, and that in time the imaginary would inevitably give way to the real, and then I should see him as he really was. Unless I had the strength of mind to do this, it would be desirable that I should give up the idea of visiting him on his own plane until my mind had naturally, in the course of time, discarded the acute memory of his past physical illness. I decided to accept his advice, and adopt both ideas, and not to make the attempt at exteriorization of my own etheric body at present, but do all I could to superimpose happy, constructive thoughts of my husband in the state of well-being in which I believed him to be, upon the unprofitable, destructive memories either conscious or subconscious which were beneficial neither to him nor to me. If his illness had brought any lesson with it, and suffering of any kind does bring a lesson in its trail, as a rule, it had been learnt. This I knew, and I also realized that any unnecessary dwelling on sorrows or pains that are past, leads to morbidity of thought and outlook. Chapter 19. A Dissertation on Prayer. In the last chapter one have related the lesson I was taught with regard to dwelling on painful memories. I took the lesson to heart, and it had benefited me considerably, both mentally and physically, but there was another lesson that I was yet to learn, one that opened my eyes more than ever to the necessity of tackling our earthly tasks and difficulties ourselves, and not inflicting them on the consciousness of those who have passed to other planes, and who have work of their own to do, and probably difficulties of some kind to contend with. We must be very careful indeed to avoid doing this, because those who love us best will be the very ones who will be most affected by our troubles, and yet they may not be in a position to help us, and it is this feeling of inability to aid us which distresses them, and may interfere with their own progress, and if we persist in thus unlawfully disturbing them, it will react adversely on us. I know that many discarnate souls are able to help those left on earth, both in a general and individual way. They are peculiarly fitted for such work by temperament, and also by training for it on their own plane, before they attempt to contact the earth conditions which it is their aim and desire to improve. The one safe, sound way we can take when we need spiritual assistance, is to ask God for it. Saint Paul said, "In nothing be anxious, but in everything, by prayer and supplication let your requests be made known to God." And in more modern times Dr. Alexander McLaren wrote, "If a man does not pray about everything, he will be worried about most things." It is good that we should speak direct to God about our problems. He is above being distressed about our worries. "My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from Him," Psalm 5. If we do this we can rely on help instantly, if it is good for us. While we are talking about prayer, let me tell you what R.C. Chapman said by way of encouraging those who sometimes feel that they are not in the right mood for prayer. "When we cannot pray at all, then it is high time to pray. We honor God by fighting with inward difficulties, and show our faith in the intercession of our Lord Jesus Christ by bringing our coldness of spirit to the great High Priest. True boldness in prayer is not to be judged by good words, but by this test: how far is God's will the guide of the soul?" The italics are mine. I realize only too well how we can excuse ourselves from prayer because we don't feel in the mood. We cannot express ourselves easily to God at the moment, but it is our very inability to contact Him, our coldness of spirit, that we should take to Him, and if we do so we shall soon find that we have caught hold again. It is a good thing to have true humility about oneself, but if it encourages us in the idea that we are incapable of, or unfit for, direct communion with God, then it almost amounts to unbelief. Again, we must be careful to ask anything according to His will. We must say, thy will, not mine. If we do this, it shall come to pass before they call, I will answer, and while they are yet speaking, I will hear. Isa. 9:24, which means that he hears our need, our thought, even before we have expressed it in words. In an earlier chapter in this book I wrote the words, He will give his angels charge over thee. I take them to mean that his angels are his ministering spirits, in whose ranks may be numbered those whom we have known and loved on earth, who have progressed on the other side, and are now in a position to become ministering spirits, or angels having charge over us. In most cases, if not all, these entities would have passed from earthly conditions some considerable time, and may have gone through many spiritual experiences, and made a deep study of life since passing over. If a good purpose is served by doing so, they are allowed to help us, especially when we cannot help ourselves. If we can help ourselves, we ought to do so. It is a cowardly evasion of personal responsibility that impels us to seek help from others if we can possibly manage without it. Wonderful help has been given from the other side under right conditions. I have had many examples of it myself. Indeed, it is often staggering to look back and see what has been done through prayer and spirit agency. God works in a mysterious way, His wonders to perform, but we must remember that His infinite mind can see what is good for us, and whether an answer to our prayer will be beneficial or otherwise. How many of us have realized, with bitter sorrow, the curse of an answered prayer? If only we had left the matter in His hands after making the request, saying, According to thy will, not mine, things would have been all right, but what often happens is we ask God for something, and instead of leaving it to Him, we follow it up by mentally concentrating all our forces on one point, that is that what we think is good for us shall and must be brought to pass, and we proceed to bring it into being, because, as I said before, thought is mind in action. This little dissertation about prayer, and the importance of not disturbing our departed friends with our personal troubles, is a preliminary to my describing a very curious and disturbing experience that happened to me soon after the events related in the last chapter. I began to have some very troublesome material affairs to attend to, and some of them appeared to be heavier than I could shoulder myself. In his earth life, my husband could not bear to see me worried, and always held the impression that I could not possibly tackle ordinary material life without his aid. Undoubtedly, that impression was at the back of his mind shortly before his passing, when he said he did not want to go to the beautiful places, and leave me behind. Knowing his natural anxiety about me, I feel now that at the period of which I speak, I ought to have taken these earthly matters more lightly, and not let them get on my mind as much as I did. Some weeks had passed since my last astral experience with my husband, and remembering his advice to me after that occasion, I was not expecting to reach him in my etheric body, nor was I definitely trying to do so while these troublesome earthly problems existed. Then, one night, I had an experience which proved that B had sensed these troubles, and strongly reacted to them in a way that might have brought untold danger and unhappiness to us both. Chapter 20. Can a spirit commit suicide? I hope that by this time I have conveyed my idea to you that in the normal waking conditions of our daily lives the etheric body finds it extremely difficult to function consciously apart from the physical. While it is in complete association with the physical, it is usually inoperative, or out of action, so to speak. There may be undoubtedly some exceptions to this rule, such as the progressed student of occult laws who has become proficient in consciously exteriorizing his astral body at will, whenever and wherever he chooses. That this has been done is a proven fact, but we are not concerned here with such extraordinary degrees of efficiency in etheric exteriorization, but with the more limited and ordinary ways in which the average man and woman is likely to experience such phenomena. If our etheric body can move out even a short distance from the physical, it is most likely that we shall see or hear something extraordinarily interesting, especially if there is someone belonging to us, linked to us, by ties of love and mutual interest, who will doubtless be waiting to encourage and help us to reach out from our usual limited conditions, and grasp their hands, if only for a moment. One night in July, 193.5. Soon after midnight, I became aware that my etheric body was slightly exteriorized, just sufficiently for me to be able to see and hear other etheric bodies and conditions around me. On this occasion, I felt myself less alert than usual, and I was once again reminded that if we have been living in a disturbed emotional condition on Earth, it affects the etheric body in such a manner that even when projected, it is more difficult for the souls from other planes to perceive or contact it. So now I could see that my husband was close beside me, just a few feet away, but apparently he was finding some difficulty in seeing me. He seemed to realize that he was near me, and he was evidently trying hard to locate my exact whereabouts, but could not do so. I spoke to him, and with some considerable mental effort, I moved farther out from my physical body and drew nearer to him and was able to reach out my hand and touch him on the shoulder. Though he did not seem conscious of the actual touch, he appeared to sense that I was close to him, and he seemed to make a great effort to contact me by concentrating on me. He began to speak. I could hear his voice, and could follow all he said. He spoke very deliberately, as one might speak on a long-distance call through the telephone if one was speaking on a matter of great importance, and wanting to make sure that the listener at the other end could really hear distinctly. My husband said he realized the extent of my difficulties, and that he felt that I needed him with me, and that if I felt I could not carry on without him, he would come back to me. I said, "How can you come back to me? What exactly do you mean?" Though he did not appear to hear the actual words, I saw by his face that he had mentally received my question, and he gave the most astonishing answer. "I could commit suicide." Amazed, dumbfounded, almost disbelieving, I asked him what he meant. Again he seemed to sense my question, and immediately replied, "There are forms of suicide on the astral plane, and I wonder if there is a form of suicide that I might take in order to be with you again, so as to protect and help you?" I cried out, "No. Of course you must not do any such thing. Don't even think of it. Put it right out of your mind at once. If you did do it, I am absolutely certain it would not benefit either of us." I remember that when he was on Earth he had disapproved of suicide from whatever angle it was viewed, or whatever the motive might be, and I felt sure that he would not have any desire to take such a step on his own account, but that it would be entirely on my behalf, in order to be with me and help me again, and I realized that I must have dwelt unduly on my earthly troubles, hugging them to myself instead of getting on top of them. But I had not fully understood that our unhappy thoughts are so easily picked up by those whose etheric bodies are often with us, or we with them. My feeling of intense dismay and anxiety to stop him thinking of such a course as suicide seemed to lend an added poignancy or power to my desire to impress my husband against the idea, for he suddenly lifted his face a little, looked in my direction, and appeared to see me. He then talked calmly and quietly to me for some time, assuring me of his never-ceasing care for me, and admitting that it had not occurred to him actually to attempt suicide, but only that he was willing to do so if his being nearer to the earth would help me. Before we parted, we both reassured each other about ourselves, my husband promising not to think of the subject of suicide again, and I informed him that whatever my difficulties were on the earth, they were not insurmountable, and I knew I could get through them all, so he must not worry. Ever since this incident I have pondered over this question: what are the forms of suicide that are open to a discarnate soul? Many suggestions have been put forward, none of them very convincing. One was that a discarnate soul could commit suicide by willfully leaving his own plane, and obsessing or possessing some person on Earth. The obsessing entity does not always show a mischievous or antagonistic attitude towards the person whom it is possessing. I knew of one case of apparent possession, when the entity was deeply attached to the girl whom it was alleged he haunted, and that his sole desire in doing so was in order to be near her. Personally, I was not sure that this, or any other similar case I have had definite first-hand experience of, was one of genuine possession. I think it was more likely due to overwhelming grief and shock on the girl's side, which had for the time being unhinged her mind and nervous system. In time it wore off, and we heard no more of the supposed obsessing entity. Another suggestion advanced was that those who wished to commit this kind of suicide were spirits who were waiting in the spiritual planes for their next incarnation on Earth, and that they might desire to anticipate the time of that incarnation, and go back to the Earth life before they were spiritually ready to do so. The idea underlying this suggestion being that those who pass over usually have to wait a certain time on the astral planes, studying and developing their souls in readiness for their next earthly incarnation, which probably takes place in 3 or 4 centuries of time. With regard to this point, I have no opinion to offer, I don't know. The theory that appeals to me as being the most feasible of any I have heard, is that those who actually live on a certain etheric plane, possibly 2 or 3 planes above the Earth, might elect to function on a lower plane, that is one nearer, possibly very near the Earth, in order to be as close as possible to the being they have left behind, and whose presence they long for. If we on the Earth cease to function on that Earth, it follows we must go through a process of dying in order to take up life on another plane. It seems possible that those who change their plane of existence over there go through what appears to be a form of death, though I am certain there is nothing painful or uncomfortable about it, inasmuch as they may change the nature of their bodies to some extent. If this is so, the process will seem to them to be a form of dying, and if they were changing from a higher to a lower plane of existence, and, in doing so, cut short their activities and development on the higher plane, it might even seem to be a form of suicide. Again, I must admit, I don't know. I can only relate what my husband said, because it constitutes a warning that anybody who is in close touch with the other side should carefully control and guard their mental lives on Earth. After this experience, I decided never again to allow myself consciously to dwell in negative thought of any kind whatever. Chapter 21. The Dream State. By this time I began to realize how many difficulties beset us when we venture to explore the etheric world. The most baffling of all seemed to be the dream state through which, as I have mentioned before, one often passes before one becomes conscious in the astral, and vice versa, on returning from a true astral experience, one again passes through a dream before one wakes. It is my experience that the memory of what one has seen or done in the astral is sometimes wiped out by the dream phase, which superimposes itself upon the astral memories, so that when one awakes one may get such a muddle of dreams and real experiences, it is extremely difficult to make sense of it. After a few experiences of this kind, people often give up in despair, thinking that the difficulties of sorting out the false from the real are so great that it is hardly worth their while to pursue their study of astral projection. One cannot blame them, but it is a pity, because they often throw up the sponge just as they are coming to the point where they might realize that it is possible to derive some helpful knowledge from the very dream condition which has puzzled and exasperated them. All my life I have dreamed a good deal. Hardly a night passed that I did not dream some farrago of nonsense, which I usually dismissed from my mind as soon as I awoke. I had paid very little attention to the subject of dreams until I began to realize the fact that there was another state into which we could enter during sleep, where we could contact other planes of existence, and meet beings who were no longer living in the limited Earth conditions, beings who could help and teach us, with whom contact could only have a beneficial result. Sometimes these discarnate souls are strangers to us, teachers and helpers whose work it is to instruct those who are sufficiently eager and venturesome to seek to obtain spiritual instruction in this manner. Others may be the ones we have loved and lost, whose features and characters are engraven on our very hearts, and who also long to comfort and bless us, even if they cannot instruct us in spiritual lore and philosophy, as the teachers can and do. Because I realize the desirability of contacting the higher astral world, and bringing back a perfect memory of it, I resented the interference set up by the dream state through which I often found myself passing after leaving the real astral. After a while it dawned on me that there had begun to be a better retention of astral memory drawn through the dream experience, a thread of true memory running through the imaginary fabric of the dream material. As soon as I had recognized this fact, I determined to hold on to the dream, instead of impatiently dismissing it from my mind on waking. By carefully sorting out the incidents of the dream, I made some interesting and helpful discoveries, prominent among them being the symbolical meaning contained in many of the apparently inexplicable happenings in the dream.